The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Wednesday. I'm Peggy Tuck. Now, coming up on the show today, well, Brexit, the Fed, interest rates, oil prices, all of these things are headlining in the news today. So we brought in an expert to decipher out all the details for you. Joining us today in studio is Wells Fargo Chief Economist John Sylvia. Now, you're not going to want to miss a minute of this, so do not touch that dial because we're going to it's all going to make sense by the end of the show. We're going to have this and more financial news coming your way this hour on Straight Talk Money. But first, here's Mike Robertson.
Good morning, everybody. Yes, we've been talking about having Dr. Sylvia on for several days. As Peggy says, he's Managing Director and Chief Economist for Wells Fargo. In addition to that, we're going to talk a little politics. Not a lot, but we're going to talk a little politics because in his career, he was also Senior Economist for the U.S. Senate Joint Economic Committee and Chief Economist for the U.S. Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. So, John, you must have touched a little politics somewhere in there, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, in fact, a couple days ago, I was walking through my lobby, and there you were on CNBC. You're a very busy man because I assume we were you in North Carolina at the time?
Because you look like
you're in, and then yesterday you're here giving a speech, and so we're really honored to have you in the studio with us today.
Well, Houston's a big market.
Yeah, Houston is a big market.
A lot of money here.
There is. Not as much as there was. You know, it's slowed down a little bit, as you probably know, from the oil. But we seem to be picking up. We'll talk about that later because it looks like Wells Fargo had a West Coast Energy Conference. And you've got a couple of, I assume, your analysts out this morning talking about the future of energy. I'd like to talk, first of all, about the subject that everybody starts every economic conversation out right now is with the Brexit and whether or not, and obviously we don't know. And as somebody wisely said this morning on CNBC, in fact, they had a Fed governor on this morning. I don't remember which one they had, but he said, you know, really, I should stop talking about it because it's really up to the British people. It's not really up to me to tell them which way to go. But if they were to leave, which I guess would be the real sea change if they were to leave, would that have an impact on us?
Absolutely. The weekend polls sort of turned towards the British remaining in the EU. Mm-hmm. As a result of that, what you saw was that the dollar weakened a little bit because the safe haven bid went out of the way. 10-year treasury rates went up a little bit, and equity markets rallied. So absolutely, if the British voted to exit, what you would expect is a slightly stronger dollar. Again, lower 10-year treasury rates and probably a negative impact on the equity market because so many U.S. companies have businesses both in the U.K. and in Europe. So absolutely, yes, it's not our job to tell them.
Right.
But when they act, we need to understand the implications of what they're saying.
Yeah, in fact, I've noticed over the last couple of weeks that the 10-year moved down from like a 181 to a 166. Was that when it looked like they were going to leave?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
There was, as you know, the markets play on momentum, and the polls had the momentum for leaving rising over time.
Right.
Until, again, that murder of the MP, and then things turned around.
Right. What would it do to the British economy if they were to leave?
Well, in the short run, it creates a lot of uncertainty. As you know, Mike, they have 2 years to negotiate a new deal. But I think it would be very difficult negotiations because basically you're saying I'm rejecting the EU, but now I would not want to negotiate a new deal with you.
Right.
And that's going to be a little bit tough negotiating. It's kind of create a lot of uncertainty. And, you know, for, you know, Britain, but especially London itself as a financial center, it does create some interesting problems because, as you probably realize, even a firm like Wells Fargo that has an office in London, we have Irish workers. We have Italian workers, and we have French workers in that office. Well, under the EU agreements, you can't have that kind of labor mobility. And so the question is, what happens to all those foreign, i.e. EU workers in London?
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy
cow. It's kind of tricky when you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, that really does filter down to the lowest
level. Even
worse,
what are you going to do with the footballers? All the English teams that have European footballers and Italian players on the football teams.
Oh, wow. Well, that's really interesting. I didn't realize that. I was kind of surprised this morning, and I didn't know if it was hype or just reality, but they had the president of Ryanair on, which I guess is an Irish airline. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is.
And they're a big airline for Britain. And he said, I will not be able to fly into the EU as I do now if we exit. He said it will completely change our business model. So I guess it starts from the top and filters all the way down to the employees. It just realigns the ship.
Absolutely. As many of you know, it just creates uncertainties. Many people here have probably flown into London Heathrow, but there's also a city, London City Airport, where you're flying back and forth to Dublin and to places in Europe, and it's kind of tricky to figure out what the new rules were going to be.
Wow. So you're right when you said earlier, it looks like it's kind of swinging back the other way. I think the last poll loss I saw was 53-47. I don't know what the margin of error that is, but I guess none of us will know until very late Thursday.
Yeah, it's hard. As an economist, I can make economic arguments why the UK would stay and why I would vote to remain. But a lot of it is emotional, and unfortunately, a lot of it really turns on the immigration issue and the feeling that, you know, we've got a lot of people coming over here. They're taking advantage of the British welfare system. They're taking advantage of the British labor markets. And some of the British people feel, you know, out.
Yeah, they do. Well, it's probably the same kind of level of anger or river of anger that Donald Trump has tapped into over here, I think. All right, so we don't know what's going to happen, but it will have an impact on us. Looks like the impact here is a dollar. There have been some questions this week from listeners about, is there a way either to play this or protect this? Seems to me like the only way to do it would be currency, and most average consumers, I don't think, have the skill or the knowledge to play currencies very, very well. So would you agree that we probably, the average investor should probably just sit still and just let it happen, whatever's going to happen?
Absolutely, because once again, you're going to have 2 years of negotiations, so we'll see how that plays out. But as you and Peggy talk to people, I would say, you know, just hold on to your hands and just don't start pushing those buttons those trades, because you might regret it very much.
Yeah, I would agree. Now, I'm going to use the 10-year to talk about something else because, you know, that 10-year has been coming down. It was I think if memory serves me correctly, it was like around 2.3 when Janet Yellen did her one and only rate increase back in December. And then it started drifting down to, you know, around 2, a little bit below 2, then kind of back up again. It's moved here, as you said lately, on this Brexit situation, but it's still lower than it was when she increased rates last December. Let's talk about the rate increases coming out there. Do you foresee? I mean, they're all over the map. You've got people say, "Oh yeah, every time they have a meeting, oh, they're definitely going to raise this time. They're definitely going to raise this time." And then you've got people out there, like some of them, who's get a lot of airtime, like Jeff Gundlach and stuff like this. And you can forget it. She's not going to raise rates this year at all. Do you have any thoughts on really what the Fed's going to do?
Well, we absolutely do take a position. I think one thing that happened, Mike, is that the first quarter GDP numbers came in very disappointing.
Yes, it did.
And also the Fed actually started this year expecting 4 rate increases, and now they've moved it to 2. And so we're sticking with 2, 1 in September, 1 in December. But if there's anything, they're probably going to do less than that. And the reason I think is pretty...
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
If you're just joining us, we're having a great show today. We've got Dr. John Sylvia with us. John is Managing Director and Chief Economist for Wells Fargo Bank, based in Charlotte. And we are pleased to have him. He came to Houston to give a speech and was kind enough to come into our studio with him. So we're going to have him all day today. So if you've got any questions, Peggy's on the box here. And if you go to straighttalkmoney.com and send her a question, we'll be glad to entertain it here on the show. Just before the break, now we were talking about deflation. And that seems to be kind of an underlying concern for the Fed. You know, we have a better economy, but not really a robust economy. But we need to kind of normalize those rates a little bit and kind of move them back up. And so thus, you know, the 2 rate increases that you're still anticipating, kind of gives them a few more options if we get into deflation. But I also read that France was already in deflation. I don't know if any other country is, but if that's the case, is that a real danger for us here in the United States?
Oh, it is. It's a huge problem. Absolutely. Japan has been in a sort of a deflationary mood for a while. Some European countries have become, you know, that deflationary mood. And it is a challenge in the United States because, as you can imagine, Mike, as inflation numbers come down, the real burden of debt or interest expense starts to rise. So that a nominal interest rate, a mortgage rate of 4 or 5%, as inflation numbers come down, that real burden tends to rise. And that creates problems for most debtors in the United States. So the real value, the real cost of your mortgage, your auto loan goes up, and that puts a depressant on what happens with consumer spending.
Yeah, so this is a real-life concern, but so far we don't appear to be in there. We seem to be just skirting above that line right now.
Yeah, Mike, if you split the consumer price index into services, typically medical care, rents, college tuition, mm-hmm. and goods, what's interesting is the goods portion, basically going to the discount store, picking up home supplies, that actually is in deflation in the United States for the last 2 or 3 years. So service inflation is around 3%. But goods actually is in deflation. So, again, no pricing power at some of these stores, and it's a challenge for them.
Yeah, it is. The only people who seem to be getting away from have pricing power now seem to be the egg people. You know, my eggs still haven't come back down from the bird flu. But and they seem to, we actually met with a gentleman in
Denver. Yeah,
in Denver, that's in that business, and he says we're still about a year away for my eggs to come back. I'm going to show you. I talked about this on the air because I just want to kind of show you that. I'm sure you saw that in the Wall Street Journal, and I was amazed at. And we're talking, folks, about the Swiss, Japan, Germany, the 10-year, and the real interest rates. And now since that publication, the German 10-year is actually, I believe, slipped below zero. We've got negative interest rates in 13 or 14 countries around the world. And they've done, as you and I were talking before the show, maybe it's just a scare tactic over here. Because you said something that really comforted me, that we're unlikely to have negative interest rates here in the United States. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, we're not going to have negative interest rates. Okay. We have just a different economy. We have a different flow. Our capital markets just work very, very differently.
All right. So there's no need for negative interest rates. So all that talk is political talk. All right.
That talk's political talk. But your article here in terms of negative rates alone struggled to lift growth from the Wall Street Journal. One of the interesting problems you run into as a financial advisor is people sort of have a target of how much money they need for retirement.
Oh, absolutely.
But if the return on the money they've put aside is diminished, they tend to save more. And so this is the problem with Japan. As they went into negative interest rates, people said, I wanted to save 5 million yen for retirement. Well, to achieve 5 million yen, they had to stop putting in more principal because the return on that principal was less.
Absolutely.
And so that's the trick with Japan. They went to negative rates, but then people saved more.
Right. And so and if that's happening here in the United States, isn't that part of the slowdown of the economy?
Because absolutely.
Because
Mike,
as a consumer, if I'm saving more, that means I'm spending less.
Absolutely.
And you have baby boomers getting older. And and John, you look like you're in the baby boomer category.
Yes, sir.
With us. So, you know, you and I just don't spend as much money as we used to.
Well, as my wife says, it's better to be above the ground than below the ground. So I'll take it for what it is.
Absolutely. But I can remember those days of going and buying, you know, whole rooms full of furniture and stuff like that. And I don't do that anymore.
No. And in fact, as Peggy was saying earlier with the millennials, they don't do that anymore.
Really?
They're much more focused on travel and services and going out to eat. So when you look at consumer spending, there's a lot more spending on entertainment and obviously consumer technology, and a lot less spent on buying an extra desk or an extra bed or an extra closet or whatever it is. So there's a change in consumer spending, but you're absolutely right. Savings rates have risen in the United States over the last year or two.
Now, I read an article yesterday. I just didn't mean to talk about this, but it kind of coincides with this, that that more and more people are having a hard time servicing debt now. Is that true?
It
seems like if we're saving more, that we would be able to deal with debt more.
When you break out the U.S. consumer into different groups and what they call quintiles, the consumer debt burden actually has been reduced for people in the top two quintiles. It still is that middle group where the income growth is very, very slow, and they still have, believe it or not, an inheritance of the debts that they accumulated prior to 2008, 2009, and so that group continues to struggle.
Yeah, in fact, I saw a chart, I guess it was last Friday, where it showed that the average income of a family over the last 20 years basically hasn't moved. It's something like $54,000,
$55,000
for a family of four, and it stayed that for a long, long time. That would seem to me to be a serious problem because, you know, even though we have not had robust inflation, not like we saw back in the 80s, we've had enough inflation that it's costing that family of four a lot more to live, have food, energy, things like that, than it did 20 years ago.
Yeah, you still have that struggle that what we call the middle income people, lower middle income people especially, continue to struggle with trying to pay those bills.
Yeah, so is this all going to end badly? I mean, it just seems to me like, you know, you were just saying, it was interesting what you were saying about how the millennials are, you know, they're spending money on enjoying life, you know, going out to dinner, or traveling and things like that. And I wonder if that is in response to all the negative input that they get. Because you and I growing up, in fact, you'll probably laugh about this. I was in a meeting yesterday with a bunch of executives, and probably the average age of the group in there is about 40 years of age, but they're all very, very successful. And I threw out the name Louis Rukeyser, and nobody in the room knew who that was, other than the only other guy in there that's as old as I am. He's actually a little older than I am. So they, you know, back then we had, you know, we had, at least when I started in the business years ago, we had one financial show. It was on Friday.
That's right.
Friday night.
And I was there and you were there at the same time.
Maryland Public Broadcasting.
Yes.
And so, because that's what brought it up yesterday, as a matter of fact. So, now people are constantly inundated, you know, and certainly within this political season, we're going to have more negative. And it seems to me like that the millennials' response is, you know, I'm just going to go out and enjoy life. You know, I don't want to deal with what my parents are having to deal with.
I wouldn't say end badly, but I think disappointing is probably the way to do it. And that ties into your political comment of why a lot of people are frustrated and disappointed with the lack of progress in their personal financial lives.
Okay. We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back. I don't think politics mixes so much with economics, but we'll talk with John Sylvia when we get back in just a few moments. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Peggy, John, and I'll be back in just a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We're fortunate this morning to have Dr. John Sylvia with us. Dr. Sylvia is Managing Director and Chief Economist for Wells Fargo. And as I said in my opening, in addition to that, in his past history, he was Senior Economist for the United States Senate Joint Economic Committee and Chief Economist for the U.S. Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. So, John, I want to ask you a little bit about politics. They say that, I've heard several times, and somebody said last week, made a good comment, they said, you know, the economy is what drives the stock market, not politics. But certainly politics must play some kind of role in it. And I think as we get closer to the election, we'll have the kind of ups and downs based upon placed upon the political season. But in the long run, is that comment correct that, you know, the economy really is what drives the stock market, not politics?
I think overall the economy does drive the stock market. Stock markets depend upon the valuation of future earnings discounted by an interest rate. And in both cases, earnings and interest rates are economics. But for an investor in individual companies, you have to really pay attention to people when they talk about corporate tax reform in the campaign. Because, yes, it's one thing to lower the corporate tax rate, Mike, but then how are you going to broaden the base? Whose special provisions are you going to take out in terms of expensing and
The loopholes is what they call
it. The loopholes.
Right? Yeah.
And then second, as you know, Mike, a lot of people in the United States, both on the Democrat and Republican side, are very frustrated with what they feel is unfair trade agreements. And so when those trade agreements might get negotiated or renegotiated again, it's going to impact different companies who operate in different countries. So if you have a company that's operating in China or South Korea, and a lot of our tech companies do, as an investor, you have to pay attention to any kind of renegotiation on trade with respect to China.
Now, that's a big platform for Donald Trump, or at least one of his big calls is he wants to get in there and renegotiate all these. But, you know, I kind of laugh because Mr. Trump, very powerful man, but he's used to being the boss. He's used to being the guy
that
he gets to go fire people. And when he tells people to do something, they have to follow him. But, you know, he's going to be negotiating with countries and with people that can say no and say, you know, we're not going to do that. Like the wall. You know, I mean, he became infamous immediately. Says, I'm going to build this wall and go to Mexico, pay for it. But there's no way to make Mexico pay for it. Every reasonable person knows that. So these trade agreements, are they in the other country's favor most of the time? I mean, are we just weak on negotiation?
Well, I think from a trade position, not only does Donald Trump have to negotiate with whoever the head of state is or whatever, mm-hmm. or the U.S. Trade Representative has to negotiate on behalf of Donald Trump, but he's going to negotiate with Congress too.
Right.
These are treaties, so
right.
they have to go through Congress. Now, the one sidebar on this is that the president evidently can use executive actions to isolate a particular situation where there's unfair trade. So, yes, in general, we have to deal with treaties, and they have to be negotiated, and whoever his U.S. trade representative is probably the number one person on negotiation. But these are treaties, and they're going to have to be negotiated with Congress. But there is some possibility for a unilateral executive action on this.
Mm. Well, certainly Barack Obama has apparently maximized unilateral executive action several times. I don't know necessarily regarding the trade, but he certainly has used his executive power frequently. So I guess the bottom line is that politics is not going to affect us that much other than on a big scale with the trade agreements and individual companies. But like you were saying, they keep pounding away at reducing corporate income tax. They say that we're just like the worst in the world. But you're right. If you give those dollars up, you have to get them from somewhere else. Is there a reasonable plan?
There's no piggy bank. Mike,
yeah.
There's no piggy bank. Sorry.
Okay. Sure. I was hoping you'd find one, John. Okay. Well, so for that, I'll just kind of move on. I'm kind of stuck on that one. All right. Another one I saw this morning, and, you know, this one I have really never quite figured out. Is this?
You read a lot in the morning.
I really do. I read. I get up very early, and then I read all day long. it takes me about 4 hours to do this. So helicopter money.
Yes, sir.
Which I guess in its simplest form means the central bank prints money and gives it to people. But Peggy and I laugh because we can never say this gentleman's name. Maybe we'll get him on the show one day. Torsten Schlok, I think. He is Deutsche Bank's chief international economist. And he says the Fed's been employing measures that are similar, not exactly, but
similar
to helicopter money via the remittances to the Treasury that in 2015 they paid the U.S. Treasury $117 billion. And his thought was, well, that's similar to helicopter money because you can distribute that out to the 125 million households and consumers. What is this helicopter money all about?
Well, I'm not sure what he is talking about precisely. In the past, the Fed does own a lot of Treasury securities. They collect interest on those securities.
Mm-hmm.
They return that interest to the U.S. Treasury.
Right.
So there is that return of remittances. Helicopter money is very different. Helicopter money says Treasury wants to spend $5. Fed creates a checking account. Here's your $5. Go spend it. So there really isn't a bond involved. There are not Treasury securities involved. It's simply, yes, exactly. We're just printing money to do this.
Okay. Well, hopefully we won't get there because that sounds very draconian.
Yeah.
That sounds almost like negative interest rates that we really don't want to get there.
So. It sounds a lot like the Weimar Republic in Germany.
Yes,
that's what it sounds like.
It really does. Absolutely. we kind of touched on this a little earlier, but I wanted to ask you because you talked about how the baby, you know, we're simply, they're not earning enough money on their capital, so they're having to save. What advice would you give? And I don't know if this is a role that you take at Wells Fargo or not. If not, I apologize. I'll just back off the question. But, I mean, you and I are baby boomers. I mean, we eventually someday want to retire. We eventually someday want to have income from our retirements. You know, you and I are probably more comfortable with equities than maybe the average consumer. Where's the average guy going to get his get the cash flow that he needs? Because it doesn't seem like it's going to improve much over the next several years. That, you know, Mrs. Yellen may move the interest rates up a couple of basis points, but the economy doesn't seem to be strong enough. Labor doesn't seem to be that strong. Current earnings seem to be lower. We talked about how the average family is really not making any more money than they were 20 years ago. This is not a good recipe for the climate for retirement for somebody saying, hey, I can settle down now and just draw income off my savings. What does a person do? Well, I've only got 60 seconds, so I talked my way into it. So I'll tell you what, John, this will give you the whole break to think about that. But that's really the biggest challenge for our listeners and for, I think, for the consumers that walk into our offices or walk into the Wells Fargo Advisors offices, is people are walking in devastated by the fact that that the anticipation of having the old 7% CD when they retired is just not there.
Absolutely.
They're
it's
almost shell-shocked.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah, they're almost shell-shocked. So, all right, folks, we're going to address that right when we come back, so stay with us. You're listening to Straight Talk Money. We'll be back in just a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We have been truly honored today to have with us in studio Dr. John Sylvia. Dr. Sylvia is Managing Director and Chief Economist for Wells Fargo and truly one of our favorite guests. I think this is the second time you've been in studio with
yes.
us. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And we're very excited, John. We kept talking about you for days coming up to this. We actually set you up pretty good, but you know you've lived up to your press clipping.
Thanks,
so
sir.
It's good. And I want to thank you before we go. Thank you so much
sure.
for being with us today. Before the break, we talked about I was talking about the plight of the average retiree, the average consumer that's approaching retirement, of not having that 7% CD that they thought they would have way back in 1990 or something. They were like, oh yeah, when I retire, just put it in CDs, live off of that. What do the folks do?
Well, I think you certainly have to focus on what you expect from retirement. Are you going to go out on the boat every day? Are you going to play golf every day? You want to sit in a rocking chair every day? You want to just do gardening in the backyard? So that when you have an idea of what amount of money you actually need on a monthly basis in retirement, then you have to focus on having the discipline to save and invest thoughtfully to achieve that level. And I don't think you can do it through speculation. You're not going to do it through gambling.
Right.
You're not going to take long odds. You're going to just look for what gives you that return that's going to achieve that level in your retirement. And the challenge we oftentimes have, Mike, especially on my side of the fence, is that people have great dreams about what they're going to do in retirement, and then they realize, I don't have the money to sustain this. And I'll go with Peggy here for just a minute. A lot of women are going to live 20 and 30 years in retirement. They need to have
That's a long time.
They need to have a well, yes, but a 65-year-old woman is probably going to be 85, 95 years old. My mom is 90 years old. All right? She probably never thought of being 25 years plus in retirement.
Right.
So I think you really got to have a plan about how you're going to spend that money and how much money you need on a monthly basis over 20 years.
Absolutely. My dad is 96.
All right.
Retired at 62 because he didn't think he'd live to 70. And he's because my grandfather died at 67, and
yes.
he thought for sure that he would be, you know, maybe add a year or two on top of that. But I remember when my father retired, I said, Dad, you're only 62. He goes, well, your grandfather died at 67. I don't think I'll probably make it to 70. He's 96. So, and he's a great man, but he keeps me working. I have to keep working. So anyway, I would be tarred and feathered if I didn't ask you about oil.
Sure.
And apparently Wells Fargo had a West Coast Energy Conference because I'm looking at an article interviews Judson Bailey and Christopher VOIE, that's another name I can't pronounce, who are with, I guess, their analysts at Wells Fargo. And they were saying that it looks like the slumber city, it looks like oil has bottomed and has formed a bottom, and that we will move higher from here. Now, the when and where, nobody said, you know, how high it would go or when we would start. But do you feel that oil may have formed a bottom here? We've reached an equilibrium between production and consumption?
Well, Mike, every month we publish a monthly outlook. And, in fact, I'm looking at it right here. And so we do have Brent front contract at $49 at the end of this year and $59 at the end of 2017.
Oh,
so that's the official Wells Fargo oil forecast.
Okay. So you're not as bullish as Raymond James. I don't know if you saw that the other day, but Raymond James came out at 80 a couple of days
well,
ago.
Well, if you're going to give me 2% plus U.S. growth and modest growth globally, some changes and transitions in China, I think I still have to be a little conservative on the oil price.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't take that 80 to the bank
okay.
at all. But, you know, we you know, that's not in my scope, but it was interesting to see. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that 80 fits in the same category when Goldman Sachs came out in January and was predicting 10. You know, those are the outliers and very rarely happen.
But then Goldman turned back around, too.
Well, Goldman likes to play. Goldman likes to play whatever the wind goes, Goldman goes. Goldman has changed. Don't you think Goldman's changed a lot as a firm over the years? I mean, when I first got in the business in 40 years ago, they were an investment banking powerhouse, and I know they're still extremely influential, but they pretty much, I think, have sold out. I mean, they became a bank so they could get TARP money and stuff like that. I mean, they're smart guys, but you probably can't say anything about them. You're too high up in a competitor. But I don't find Goldman to be the same quality firm that it used to do. But it's still a big boy. So oil is okay. So you think that we're kind of at least forming a bottom. Is there another area that looks good to you? Healthcare always comes up. Is an area where there's going to be opportunity,
well, especially in Houston.
As we go forward here, you know, because the economy is it's kind of like the warm porridge, or it's not real hot, it's not real cold. People, yes, we have more jobs, but they're jobs at lower wage scale, so they're not going to really, they're not high quality jobs that people are going to be able to go out and spend the money and stimulate the economy. Have we reached kind of an equilibrium that we could stay in for a long time? I just think that I look at Japan, which has stayed at zero interest rates for almost two decades now. Have we reached that kind of equilibrium where it's going to take some kind of an event one way or another to push us one way or the other? Otherwise, we're just going to kind of muddle along.
Yeah, it was interesting that the Federal Reserve had lowered its potential GDP estimates to 2%. And
yeah.
We've had about 5 years, we've had about 2% growth. That seems to be what our equilibrium is.
Wow.
Now, healthcare benefits because it's in economic terms, it's a superior good. In other words, as your income and the prosperity of society rises, we tend to want to spend more on healthcare, oftentimes preventive healthcare. Oftentimes, LASIK surgery, for example.
Right.
So healthcare does benefit, and, you know, you've got a huge healthcare complex here in Houston. So.
Right, we do. Yeah, it's a big thing for our economy. Is there anything out there, in closing, is there anything out there that worries you? As you look on the economic landscape, is there a segment that worries you? Is there a economic statistic that you keep seeing that's bothersome to you? Or do you think we're okay.
What keeps you awake at night?
Yeah.
I would call it idiosyncratic risk. The risk of...
Oh, there's a big word.
The risk of odd events showing up that create uncertainty, either with respect to an individual company or investment, or with respect to an emerging market nation. And so those are the challenges that we end up with. Trials in Brazil about corruption. I mean, if you're an investor in emerging markets in Latin America, all of a sudden you got these trials in Brazil, your total portfolio is thrown up in the air. So that's what worries me the most. I think we are at about 2% economic growth. We have modest inflation. I don't think the Fed's going to be all that aggressive. But that's what worries me. In politics, in an election year, a candidate making a comment about an individual company or an individual provision in the tax laws mm-hmm. or trade – or immigration. Those are the kind of things that throw people off.
One of the idiosyncratic risks that I've heard that could be out there is the failure of the Chinese banks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a concern? I mean, you're in banking. Is there a concern? Does Wells Fargo look at that and monitor that? Is there a concern about the Chinese banks?
Oh, yeah. We definitely monitor it. We have someone who looks at international banks per se. The big challenge there, Mike, is that it's hard to understand the data in the sense of comparing it to American banking data. The accounting is not as clear, and the separation between the government and these individual banks is not as distinct as it is here.
It's hard to know whether or not you're being told the truth, unfortunately, by them. So, anyway, John, thank you so much for being with us today. It has just been a wonderful show.
Thank you, Mike.
We appreciate the time.
You guys are great.
Thank you, folks, for listening. I hope you have a great day. I hope you make a little money today, but more than anything else, I hope God blesses you and your family. God bless you. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.